What's up, everybody? It's John. Before we get into this week's episode, just a quick note. There is now, as of now, a New York Times audio app. It's a Times subscriber app that has all the Times audio products on it, exclusive shows, article narration, etc. There are short pieces about culture and cooking and other parts in the news. JP is on there every week doing playlists. Lindsay is on there every week talking about songs. We've got headlines. We've got articles read by Times reporters, articles from other magazines that are narrated, podcasts, The Athletic, This American Life, Serial. It's all in one place. The app is available at nytimes.com/audio app. Get on that.
Hey, John, sorry to interrupt. It's Pedro. Quick question. Are we on that app?
Popcast, from what I understand, Popcast is also on there.
Cool.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast. You are I Go to War with These Stars, no George Lucas, of Music, News, and Criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Tactile record from Jesse Ware there. Extremely tactile. That's from the new album, which is called That Feels Good. Sorry. Is there an exclamation point missing from this record? Anyway, that's called Free Yourself. This is the fifth album by Jesse Ware, an artist who, frankly, has the universal acclamation of the New York Times pop music staff. We should have a kind of like an honorary like cup or trophy for artists that fall in this category of beloved across like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like anyone who shows up in our department loves the artist. Jesse Ware falls in that category. Jesse Ware, maybe not the most popular musician that falls into that category, but nevertheless, no shortage of Jesse Ware coverage in the New York Times, including here on Popcast. The OG Jesse Ware stan, Karen Gans, is here.
Hey, John. It's good to be back. It's been a minute.
We're happy you're on the couch. Is Richard there with you?
I'm on a chair, but he is nearby. Yes, this is my new spot. I've hurt my back sitting in my old spots. We've relocated.
Okay, we don't want that. We maybe need to get you one of those. I see him on TikTok. It's like a weird harness that like pulls your shoulders back.
Yeah, we're not going to do any of that. Oh,
okay,
thank you.
I think it's for ballroom dancers. Anyway, Lindsay Zoladz is here, a.k.a. Lenny Ware. Lindsay, welcome. Lindsay, you profiled Jesse Ware in early COVID. Karen, you chit-chatted with Jesse Ware recently about, I don't know, matinees and stuff. Just very interesting.
Accurate, yeah.
That Feels Good came out recently. First of all, why are there only two exclamation points in this album title when I feel like there should be a third one? What's happening here?
It's like, Godspeed you, Black Emperor. It moves every time you want to say it differently. You can put the emphasis where you wish, John.
Is that what it is? They're mobile exclamation points. They're choose your own adventure exclamation points.
I think it gets less confusing when you listen to that song because it is very much that feels good. It's like percussive.
Wow. We're gonna have to put a parental advisory sticker if we keep talking about that song. Okay, one thing that's come up that came up, Lindsay, when you talked to Jesse, and also that Jesse has been discussing in a number of interviews is, let's just put it out there, it's a horny record. It's a very, very horny record. And that's something that she feels like she's arriving into. And also our friend Julianne Shepherd reviewed this album for Pitchfork. Shout out Shep. And underscored that there had previously maybe been a little bit of a disconnect between the Jesse Ware who has the podcast with her mom, very loose, like kind of like untethered, and the Jesse Ware on record. Let's maybe just start, Lindsay, with the last 3 years of Jesse Ware. We'll get kind of into the old stuff because you know I'm not going to get through this episode without playing Wildest Moments. So We'll get back to that. But can we talk a little bit about 2020 in the Jesse Ware mythos and what was happening, obviously, in that COVID era and with the podcast that kind of led to this metamorphosis musically, ultimately led to it?
Jesse Ware was one of several pop musicians who released a disco album early in COVID and yes, had recorded it and had it ready to go before discos became just living rooms. This is the time of the Dua Lipa record, Future Nostalgia. It's the time of Chromatica. It was the time of What's Your Pleasure, the fourth Jessie Ware record, which, like you suggested, is this departure from the two albums that preceded it. It's really her just leaning into making like a very specific kind of dance music, not caring as much as she has seemed to in the past about commercial success and landing sort of a radio hit. It's produced entirely with this producer, James Ford. It's a result of them, just their collaboration. And it really hits in a way that I think her last two albums hadn't. Again, she's kind of on these last two albums trying to go for almost like the Ed Sheeran lane or something. She has like a song that she wrote with Ed Sheeran.
Pre-COVID.
Say You Love Me. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I'm jumping around here. But I guess to just say What's Your Pleasure in 2020 feels like a real pivot for her. But it also arrives at a moment when there is kind of like a sudden glut of neo-disco music. And I think that record really rose to the top. And at least critically, and people that were relatively tuned in to all this thought this record was better than Dua Lipa's Future Nostalgia, which I also echo that opinion. And so became...
Well, you're solving two different problems. Okay, we'll come back to that.
Yeah, I think too, like there's this genre now of like the pandemic dance album. Mm-hmm. And I think already What's Your Pleasure has been canonized in that way. But Jessie also, as you mentioned, had started this podcast called Table Manners with her charming mother, Lenny. And had really had some unexpected success with it. I think the podcast had a much wider reach than her music actually did at that time. And she, when I interviewed her in 2020, she talked about how she would get recognized on the street because of her talking voice, like from the podcast. And I don't want to venture a percentage of what listeners weren't familiar with her music before, but I think there are quite a few people that didn't know Wildest Moments or didn't know her early stuff.
The thing that comes up in your profile is she basically said I assume the financial windfall, to the degree that there are financial windfalls in podcasting, if there are, I'm not familiar with them. That said, it's the popcast.myshopify.com. If you'd like to buy a t-shirt or some stickers, proceeds to the New York Times Neediest Cases Fund. Just throwing that out there for windfalls. But that I assume the success of that podcast, which has been around maybe 15 seasons, if I'm reading that correctly, in recent coverage, whatever a season might be, allowed her to take a different approach with her music, which is to say, not have to steer into the kind of prevailing trend of the moment. Karen, is that safe to say?
From editing Lindsay's wonderful profile, I learned this. And I followed up on it when I talked to Jessie more recently, just to see if it was still the case. Basically, you know, her music was, it was in like a soulful lane, and it was definitely, I don't want to say adult contemporary, but it was mature, and it wasn't
restrained.
It was restrained.
She was tight. She's a tight singer. Not in a bad way. Just
no,
a
she has
tight.
A gorgeous voice. We'll get yeah. there. But those songs on those previous records were just like, it's very hard to find a real way in into that lane, and that she was struggling financially, and that the podcast did afford her this moment of like creative unleashing. And she basically threw it all at the wall on What's Your Pleasure and was like, this is what I kind of want to make right now. If it works, it works. And it did work with the lower expectations that she had set for it. And now she toured on that record last fall, and it was amazing. She ended up getting some dates opening for Harry Styles in Chicago, which is a very big deal in arenas. She'll be back on tour for this album now that feels good later this year. It really does seem like it was a creative uncorking, but I will say something else about the horniness of the music.
Uncorking.
Yes.
I clocked that too.
Thank you.
Wow. You're just going to slide that
there's
in.
There's a bottle pop song on the new album. It's all
a great one.
Oh, yeah. I know. Oh, I know. But I'm just saying, there's creative on this. That was good. That was smooth. I like that.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I do edit over here. But but something interesting that I think must be said at the outset of the conversation is that she has said that all of these songs are like a fantasy, that she does mm-hmm. not live a wild, luxurious life of spinning around disco balls in pearls all the time. She's got three kids. She's married to her high school sweetheart. She lives like a fairly regular life. And that in the music, she has found license to, you know, sort of like uncover these parts of herself and dream other people's dreams. In many cases, like her gay male fan base, which she talks about all the time. I wanted to make a point, which maybe I'm wedging into the conversation too early, but I started thinking about it earlier. So I'm just going to say it. You all stop me if you want. I find her to be like a kissing cousin to Kelly Clarkson in so many ways. No, but hear me out here. Vocally, extremely powerful, very effective, personality-wise, like exceptionally appealing and charming, does well in a chat show format, as Kelly does. But where Kelly also excels at Kellyoke, I was actually watching one this morning. She did Kylie's Can't Get You Out of My Head. Absolutely exquisite. Where Kelly also excels at covering other people's music and being an interpreter of other people's songs, Jessie is like an interpreter of other people's moods and fantasies. Like, she really has sucked in this nightlife disco-like fantasia and spit it back out at people, and it works so well. Discuss.
I love that.
And is this how podcasting works? I just go, discuss.
I can't believe we got 10 minutes. We're not even 10 minutes into the episode, and you've already likened Jessie Ware to Kelly Clark. It's amazing.
I feel like Lindsay is with me, but I'm not 100%. But I feel like she is.
I'm not even saying it's wrong. I'm just saying, if I had sealed, like, in an envelope, if someone had said, like, hey, can you just write the thing that Karen is most likely to say on this episode? I probably would have written Jessie Ware equals Kelly Clarkson, sealed in an envelope, and, like, put it in the drawer for, like,
let's
20
try
minutes
that
ago.
Next time.
Yeah, I might do that to open it up, theatrically rip the envelope open and be like, ha-ha. Okay, LZ, what do you think?
You brought up a point, Karen, you made me think of something that I haven't really thought about with Jessie before. And you mentioned the gay male fan base, and that was very apparent when I saw her earlier this year on tour. It was an amazing show, but had seen her like earlier, and there's definitely a different crowd and people that are there to dance and dress up in their disco finery. And I wonder, like, in this moment where we're very quick to accuse someone of queer baiting, like, how she has been able to get this queer audience around her with it feeling strangely genuine and not exploitative in the way that it can feel to a lot of other artists. And maybe that's just because she's not quite as mainstream as someone who would get that criticism. But I think there is just this perception of incredible genuineness about her and a kind of charisma that, again, the podcast unlocked, and then she's allowed to be that podcast person, like, on stage and in her stage banter, mm-hmm. and always was to an extent. But I agree with that point we started out with it at the top, that there's something almost like glacial about her music before. That was like a word that I often think of in reference to her first album, Devotion, which I absolutely love.
Incredible work.
But it almost sounded like it was made by like a shy person or someone a little reserved and not in the mix the way that she is. And I think there's been something really beautiful about her being able to both, like you said, Karen, like, channel these other fantasies and these other worlds and these alternative lives that she's living out in these songs, while at the same time, like, injecting more of her own personality into the music. Like, she's doing two opposite things at once and really has continued it, I think, in an exciting way on this new record.
To the queer baiting question, and thinking about her performance, not in the literal sense on stage, but like her overall care, like, she does not appear to be performing an aesthetic. I think some of the artists who get tagged with that, what the subtext of that conversation is there is something that is happening prior to the recordings of the records that says we are going to orient ourselves into performing an aesthetic that we hope will appeal to a gay audience in a very craven way. Mm-hmm. You do not get the sense that Jessie Ware is doing that, both in the music and also in the way the music is juxtaposed with the sort of public-facing personality and the other things. The only pushback I would say, Karen, is I do think a lot of performers inhabit aesthetics or characters that they are not living in their life. It's that in and of itself is maybe not that much of a surprise. If anything, And we don't have to jump all the way back to the first album, but I will say that if I have any hesitation about the new album, it's that it does feel a little on the nose right off the top. I have to say, I had a moment where I was like, it's giving Lizzo. It's giving a little bit of like deep optimism.
Sean.
And I'm saying this, I'm sorry. This is, we're here to speak truth. We're here to speak our truth.
But you like Lizzo now, John.
This is, I actually,
coming from you.
Well, okay. If we're going to sidebar really fast, I was driving this weekend.
I might have missed a chapter of this.
Okay. If we're going to sidebar really fast, I was driving this weekend. I don't think I've publicly talked about this, but I was driving this weekend and I was in the car and I was listening to KTU. And a Lizzo song came on, and I didn't like immediately clock it as a Lizzo song. I just was driving, and I was just like, I feel great. I feel like invigorated. I feel enthused. I feel jubilant. Everything that Lizzo wanted me to feel, I felt, and I had to gut check myself. Now, maybe it was just the mood that I was in that day. Maybe I was particularly susceptible. It's tough to say. But I did have a moment with a Lizzo song within the last 48 hours. That did happen. Now, that said, there can be something I find a tiny bit enthusiasm by numbers about that particular music. And I do feel that in a couple of places on this album. Maybe we should just talk about the title track, which should come with parental advisory. Let's just go ahead and listen to that. Feels good.
Wow. A title that's just meant to destroy poor Pedro. I'm so sorry, Pedro. Cruelty. Cruelty.
Feels good.
When we're talking about the music that Jessye Ware is making in the context, especially of these other contemporary artists who are toying with the format of updated disco, like pop-oriented disco, I think to actually put her in a separate part of the conversation that does not include artists like Lizzo feels wrong. And I wonder if a track like this, even though it is the intro, it's not like a full song, but like something along this line with the right pachinko could end up a kind of like pop hit, quote unquote. So why aren't we thinking of Jessye Ware in that way? And I think we're not because of her origins. We're not because of the podcast and the kind of reality. Also, I was like doing some research for this episode, I came up with a Daily Mail story that had maybe like the best Daily Mail headline, or like a very solid Daily Mail headline, which is Jessye Ware gives birth to third child and immediately eats a burger in bed.
Bless her.
That's what I'm like, literally, like, truly,
she's
not to be all like
queen.
2020 about
her.
It, but yeah. We stand a relatable queen. You know what I mean? Like, that's
you know what
that
else
is.
I would say, though, briefly to interrupt you about that feels good.
Please
I think
do.
You're taking her too seriously. Jessye has a sense of humor. They're the B-52s are on a very laughy track on this record. I think it's pleasure with a dose of a grin on this one. Like, you know, she sort of knows where she's pushing the envelope. When you call your first song in the album, That Feels Good, and you make a bunch of people, including Kylie Minogue, record themselves like sexually saying that, it's a joke. Don't take it so seriously.
Who said I was taking it seriously?
It sounded like you were taking it seriously.
Isn't that just like social media? Isn't that just like it? Okay, maybe now's the time to talk a little bit, speaking of seriousness, to talk a little bit about this sort of like 2.0 music of Jessye Ware versus the 1.0 music of Jessye Ware. And obviously the early Jessye Ware records are collaborations with dance music producers, Subtract, Disclosure, singing within frameworks that were not her framework, I'm just going to assume. Like, not in a bad way, just like you show up and they have a part and they want you to sing it. Maybe, even if those songs are great, which I do think they are, maybe we're not hearing the fullness of Jessye Ware on those songs. Is that safe to say?
I think so. When I spoke to her in 2020, she talked a little bit about how she was not someone that set out to be a musician or even like in the industry. She thought she was going to go to law school or something. She was
or be a journalist.
Her
I forgot about that. I forget. Yeah, literally, LOL. Like,
yeah,
truly. Dodge the bullet there, Jessye.
No, it's, and I very much, I think the Disclosure song on that big Disclosure record, Settle, that she was at, like that, I think that sort of opened some doors for her from what I remember. But there was very much this moment of producers just needing a singer on a track like that, and it being more about the producer than the singer.
especially in a club-oriented context. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I think she, when I talked to her, she sort of came to it through that and started out as the featured singer on some of these club tracks and then got to make her own record. I think she said she kept feeling like she was getting away with it. At any moment, like the dream was going to sort of evaporate and she was going to go back to law school or something.
I think she's a relatable queen. Right? She remains normal. I think that's the thing.
She is mother times three. So yeah, I think there was a sense of she wasn't necessarily in as much creative control as she has come to later. But I've been thinking too about the kind of arc of like how difficult it is for someone coming up that way to have the level of longevity that she has had and to be able to kind of reinvent herself, particularly as a woman. I think the difference between when you were saying, what's the difference between sort of a more mainstream version and this? And I think some of it is like ageism. It feels rare to quote unquote allow a female artist, specifically like a female pop singer, to completely reinvent themselves in their mid-30s and then find this new lane and this new level of success, and one that is more sexualized than her previous music was. Like, I think that that's something that's really interesting to me and gratifying and worth celebrating, I think, about this unexpected album 4 and 5 success that she's having. It doesn't happen like that very often. Whether you're more of an underground pop star or a mainstream one, like it's a pretty rare story.
I would add one thing to that, which is that I think the nature of what makes pop success, and I think we should just caveat slightly. I mean, Jessie Ware is not like on the Billboard Hot 100. I mean, this is like a very specific kind of critic-oriented success. Not to knock it, it's just like it's not Billboard Hot 100 success. It's a different thing. But I do think that the sort of pop star or potential pop player that gets maybe a disproportionate amount of attention now in this current moment is someone who has a full cross-media personality. It's not simply, oh, great song, big star. It's not that. It's more interesting person. I wonder if the songs are good. Oh, the songs are good? Great. And she's actually very well suited to that particular moment to be like a slightly more mature version of really what's happening across pop music. And the era of the early collaborations on the first album was different. It was only 10 years ago, but it was a very different time. And this is when we're going to play Wildest Moments, I do want to say, because it'll bring me a tremendous amount of joy. This is Jessie Ware, 2012, Wildest Moments. Tremendous song. This album, excellent. I saw Jessie performing at the Box sometime in this window, 2012 or 2013. I don't remember when this was. What a sparkling voice. Really, really commanded the room, not so much with like her presence, but with her voice, which is a harder thing to do. I think it's easy to command a room with presence. It's harder to command a room with voice. Really, really exceptional singer. But when you hear the vocals from this era compared to the vocals to the current era, what you hear retroactively are these kind of implied boundaries. The voice is not going, it's not going huge, it's not going, it's not sloppy or serrated at the edges at all. It's very, very taut. That seems to have changed.
This song was concocted in a lab. Obviously, I love this song, but it was concocted in the lab that was next to the lab where Ryan Tedder was making Halo and Already Gone for Kelly Clarkson and Beyonce.
Wait, are you being literal or are you being
Does it not
metaphorical?
Sound exactly like
Oh, okay.
Songs?
I thought you were being like literal, like we have photo evidence from Instagram.
No, I'm just imagining the lab where, and it's a great song, but it is restrained because it was designed to do exactly what it did, to become a wedding song, to become a giant hit. I agree with you. Do you still enjoy this song we listen to? I do because I love Jessie, but like the familiarity, the alignment with those other two songs, it just kills me.
Even though I enjoy these two more recent records, I still connect more strongly to this first album. There are moments on the new album, the Lizzo thing, like obviously I said it just to kind of like poke a tiny bit, but like it's edging towards, it's not parody, it's not quite right, but it's like some specific rendition of a genre. Okay, like Pearls. Can we listen to Pearls?
The team that did this song is the team that did a lot of the Dua record.
Yeah. Not my favorite song on the album, I have to say.
I don't even dislike it. Like, of course it's by the Dua Lipa, which is just stitched together what I was saying before. Is there not a pachinko where these songs end up in the same places as Lizzo songs or Dua Lipa songs? Like, probably.
Yeah, I would love that too. One point I want to go back to on Wildest Moments, though, is I think that song in particular, and also a lot of that record, is written and produced and designed to really show off like a virtuosity in her voice, and that she can belt out these songs. And that was actually true of the two records after Devotion, I think, too. Tough Love in, I think, 2014, and then A Glass House, which was the moment before she made this pivot.
What a nice way to put that. Yeah.
She really can belt out a ballad and has this incredible velvety tone in her voice, but she's using a virtuosic voice for more playful things on the new record. And it's funny, like I love What's Your Pleasure and might rank that a little bit above this more recent record. And there's moments on that record where she's really singing beautifully and like the quote, but I, until seeing her live a couple months ago, like I almost forgot how good her voice, like she sounded incredible live and really was able to do some of the runs on that record, like live in a way that took my breath away and was like, oh yeah, Jessie Ware's a great singer. But I think these songs, that's not the first thought you're meant to have. A song like Wildest Moments, I think that is the first thought that you're supposed to have. There's a lot of other atmosphere and things going on production-wise in these songs that her voice almost becomes an afterthought. And, you know, that's good or bad depending on how you feel about it. But it's almost like this weapon that she has in the back of her pocket of like, oh yeah, I can just like belt it. Like even as poppy as these hooks are, there's some real like stratospheric high notes and just like leaps melodically in the choruses of some of these songs that are really hard to pull off.
Can I bring up a song though that does the opposite of that I feel like Karen's gonna have real opinions on?
Yeah. Uh-oh.
Can we talk about Shake the Bottle?
I love Shake the Bottle. Yes.
Yeah, we all like Shake the Bottle. Sorry, Don.
I'm not saying I dislike it. Like, y'all are acting like people fun on Twitter. Jesus.
Have fun.
Like, Shake the Bottle is a very fun record that clearly nods to Madonna on Vogue.
Oh, I likened it when I interviewed her. I was like, oh, you've become Debbie Harry.
Okay, let's speak about it. To me, that's the outlier song on the record. Like, it's interesting to hear you guys talk about Pearls as this kind of outlier. But to me, Shake the Bottle feels like the outlier song on the record. Tell me a little bit about...
I felt like she was doing Rapture. My God, Jessie Ware, our new favorite rapper. And she was like, oh God, is that what I was doing? And I was like...
This is like when I told Kesha she was rapping on her first album. And that was,
oh my
that
God.
Was a very fruitful discourse that she and I
that
had.
Was, I remember
nature,
the headline.
The nature of rapping, yes.
The main difference between That Feels Good and What's Your Pleasure to Me is that it's a lot blacker of a record. It's leaning into the more soulful sides of disco. There's horns, just vocally, the whole vibe of it just feels a whole lot warmer. And What's Your Pleasure is just very chilly and synthy. It felt to me like she was just like, obviously there's this whole other half of the disco soul era that I feel like she's addressing on this record, especially with all these horns from Coco Roco, which is this great Afrobeat band from London. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a complicated history of English soul singers and their relationship to blackness. And I feel like she's managed to skirt a lot of that conversation over the years, even though some of those earlier records really are more to me, they're leaning soul records. And the one thing I actually have to say about Devotion, which I listen to extremely rarely, even though it's not bad, it's just not for me, is I was walking around yesterday. I couldn't struck by how many of those songs sounded like Janet Jackson songs. Am I totally nuts? Or do you guys hear this too?
There's a lot of like
Jam and Lewis-esque production on those songs. Yeah. I blew my mind hearing it anew right now. Not that she was in a direct conversation with like Amy Winehouse, but I'm just thinking like, you know, it's a part of her art that I feel like was sort of left undiscussed. And I didn't see a lot of conversation about that in conversations about this album too, which I found strange because it seemed to me that the missing piece from the last record to this record was soul.
I think maybe the reason it wasn't discussed as much in the first era is because of her specific ties, I think, to club culture.
Yeah.
That first album really reminded me a little bit of, remember that singer Naya, N-I-I-A, mm-hmm. who did almost like a Sade-ish kind of first album? Like, it reminded me kind of that a little bit. But I think because it was coming from a club, like a quote-unquote club music singer perspective, it somehow skirted that discourse. But then I think part of the reason you're not seeing that discourse here as much is because I said there's a tiny, tiny bit of gimmickry, performed genre stuff. And because I think it's actually blocking the discourse about the singing, and it's a little bit like leading with the framework and not at all with what's coloring inside the framework. Maybe that's kind of where that disconnect is happening.
When you said to me earlier, when I was bringing up the point about her inhabiting personas, and you said many pop stars inhabit personas, I was just waiting for when we were going to talk about Renaissance.
Yeah, I was listening to That Feels Good earlier today. And I Karen, I think you and I share, like, I think the back half of this record is better than the front, although I do love Free Yourself. I think that was a great single.
I think
single.
Totally the opposite.
Sense though, John.
But I get there's sort of a run of a couple songs on the back half of it that does feel like it's a club set the way that parts of Renaissance do. Like, there's a flow to the way I think Beautiful People into Freak Me Now, another favorite of ours, into Pop the Bottle. There's kind of it, she gets carried away in this kind of dance floor ecstasy, and it just takes over in that way, in a way that reminds me of Renaissance. I was also thinking in that context, though, like, are there samples on this record? Or if there are, like, it's not.
It's mostly played by the band, right?
So I think like that feels like a big difference between those two things, that I think Beyonce is like trying to be referential in a literal way of, I am going to sample this thing that I'm referencing or get this person on the record. And I think the Jessie Ware, these last two records, like, if they're satisfying the purists, it's because they're getting the details right of how this song and this production is supposed to sound. Like, they're getting the right people to play drums or to reference. Like, it's referencing, it feels referential to certain songs and genres without literally sampling it, which is kind of the shortcut way to do something like that now. So I think that also feels rare and not as pandering to the pop audience.
Let's say on principle, Beyonce and Jessie Ware are doing the same thing. I'm not sure it's exactly true, but let's say that they are.
Okay.
The stakes of them doing it are so radically different. And there's something much more overt about the choices that Beyonce made. But also, I think you cannot remove Beyonce's aesthetic choices from, like, the legal frameworks and pressures of being one of the five most popular musicians on the planet, basically. And it's like she doesn't have the liberty to put blinders on. I think Jessie Ware can put blinders on a little bit and just be like, I'm just doing this thing and I got a band and we're doing vibes. That's what we're doing. Beyonce is doing it, and there's 30 forensic musicologists tearing the vibes apart, trying to figure out where they can sue.
And analyzing the sorts of things about queer baiting and the racial politics of it.
Yes.
That sort of is what comes with being more of an A-list pop star than Jessie Ware is. I think what she lacks in mainstream popularity, she's almost found that more underground space to be really liberating, both creatively and just expectation-wise. Like, it's, I think that's what we keep going back to too, is that something about not aiming to have the Beyonce hit or not aiming to have the Ed Sheeran hit anymore really has allowed her to do something that is both like smaller and more expansive at the same time.
Beyonce is much like Jessie Ware, a mother of three. She's actually older. I believe she's 41 and Jessie's 38. Perhaps the fantasy that Beyonce is embodying on Renaissance, which is of a similar ilk to the one that Jessie has embodied on her past two albums about sort of like nights in the club and fantasies and letting go of all your responsibilities. You know, those ideas are relatable as they are both mothers of three over 35, which we know is a death knell age in pop. I don't know. I just find I think the lines that you can draw between these records are interesting, and probably we were not going to have time to explore them further.
I agree in the big picture of character work, inhabiting the personality, which is sort of what I was trying to get at earlier, which is to say whether this album is a true document of her experience or a performed version or a fantasy version. I think I was just trying to say it wasn't inherently necessarily interesting if it was inhabiting a fantasy, because I think a lot of people do. And I think you're right to underscore that the Beyonce album is sort of like fundamentally a fantasy record as well. Like it's moving within the realm of character work. And that's great. I will say that there is a meticulousness to Renaissance that I'm not hearing on this album. But Beyonce and Jessie Ware, maybe where they are not aligned is I think Beyonce is a perfectionist and Jessie Ware, there's something like incidental. And this goes back to the earliest part of this conversation about stumbling into pop stardom, stumbling into your pop music career. There is something still lightly incidental about how Jessie Ware approaches the music making process that does feel a little bit like, we'll just have a laugh. We'll see what, even the part in Lindsay's story where you're talking about her living maybe within walking distance of the producer. So it's like, I guess we'll make record today. And if it doesn't work, it's fine. Whereas I do not believe that is how Renaissance was made. Just educated guess. Shout out to all our friends at Parkwood, by the way.
Beyonce is a perfectionist and Jessie is more of a vibist. And she plays the vibe, and that's what she does live so effectively too. You're not going to see Beyonce bantering with the crowd in the same way, but that's fine. Everybody has their skill set. We love you, Beyonce. Looking forward to the tour later this summer.
Can we talk about the Ed Sheeran song?
Yeah, I want to.
Say You Love Me. Let's listen to it a little bit.
Say you love me to my face. I'm needing more than your embrace.
You listen to the first 0.7 seconds of this song and you know Ed Sheeran wrote it. No one ever take Ed Sheeran to court again. I just want to say that. If you were listening last week, me and Ben Cesario got into this, but I want to reiterate it. Nobody take Ed Sheeran to court anymore, because you could tell an Ed Sheeran song literally within microseconds of an opening, including when they're sung by other people. So if you are a rights holder, just eat it. Look somewhere else for a paycheck. Anyhow, I hadn't listened to the song in quite a while, and listening to it, I was shocked by how un-Jessie Ware-ish it sounds. Either old Jessie Ware or new Jessie Ware. This feels like the peak concession moment. And it's not a peak disco pop concession moment. It's a peak, I think you mentioned in your piece, like graduation song, X Factor type song. If you can like point to like where it went wrong, and this is a successful song, it's not that it's unsuccessful, but it's like, this is not it. If she was doing a career's worth of this, moving forward from that point, I don't think that would feel great.
And there are some songs that I really love on that record, Tough Love. This is not necessarily one of them. But what's interesting to me is like how she can do that well. Like she sounds great on that song. Like there's some really impressive vocal stuff that she's doing that's very powerful, but it's not her. Like you said, like we're even calling it the Ed Sheeran song. It's become, I think, a pretty popular X Factor and other like vocal competition song selection in the UK, because it has that showcase for a real belted out kind of voice.
I feel like we've done a good job talking about Jessie Ware as a musician, even if we have not always agreed upon those things. But I do have a question about her capacity in a true art form, the only true art form perhaps, which is podcasting. So I have not been so blessed as to listen to the Jessie Ware podcast with her mother, but y'all have. Can you talk us through a little bit about what the listening experience to that show is like and has evolved over time to the degree that it has.
It's joyful.
What's a typical episode like?
I recently listened to one with Pink, and they generally have somebody over. They've got big names. And the press cycle for this, I noticed everybody kept mentioning McCartney.
Obviously, they have Paul McCartney?
Yes, sir.
Not like Bob.
No, the sir not like McCartney.
Teddy McCartney.
No. They really do get tons and tons of names. And people come to their home and they, like, you know, they cook a meal and they joke around. It's really funny, you know, and it is very, there's a Jewish humor to it. Another great, yes, legacy in podcasting, I presume. But it's her mother is extremely endearing, and the way they relate is very approachable. And it does provide you with this, as we were discussing earlier, this whole other dimension of her fame and her personality and her persona and where her art comes from, where you really, I think when you feel you know her, again, that also might lend to why she hasn't been accused of so many things in terms of borrowing from culture, because she's very relatable and genuine. And it comes through in those kinds of conversations.
She comes across as a fan, I think, of a lot of the people she has on, which feels very genuine. And then also a friend to some of these peers too. My very favorite moment from Table Manners was actually in the pilot when they had Sam Smith over. And that was what you may have seen or heard the headlines of, when Sam Smith admitted that they thought that Mexico was in Europe. So they get that kind of
unfortunate
truth. In context, I have to say, in context,
it was funny. It was funny.
I almost could understand. I recommend.
I just want to go on the record. I have not heard this episode. I'm just not support. Like, y'all are being very forgive. Like, if anybody else did funny. That, y'all would be mad. I'm just saying that.
And I believe Lindsay cited this one in her profile, that when Ed Sheeran came on, he revealed that his nickname as a child was like Eddie Two Dinners or something.
Two Dinners Teddy.
Yeah.
Which is great. That I support.
They get people loose, like,
it's disarming.
Both
yes,
with the wine sometimes, but also with the humor and the mother-daughter humor.
It's the drink champs of white pop. Is that what we're saying? Wow. Okay. Well, Nori got to watch his back because they're coming for the crown.
It has a hot ones quality to it, where you're catching somebody very off guard. It involves eating. Her mother is extremely appealing and has become a star in her own right. And Jessie also has, she's got a cookbook or a book about cooking called Omelette. I have a copy of it somewhere in the house. I am a very loyal fan, just not a very devoted reader, evidently, but.
That's okay. It's the purchasing as a future book author, and Lindsay as well, a future book author, and Karen, also a book author. It's the purchasing that counts. You don't have to read. It's just very simply the purchasing that counts.
It's the hardest part. Yes.
That is the hardest part. It's a true story. Okay, what Jessie Ware song? Let's actually go with an older Jessie Ware song. So I feel like we've rinsed the new album a little bit. But what's like an older Jessie Ware song that maybe doesn't get the care and attention that it deserves?
Champagne Kisses from Tough Love is a song of hers that I really, and I think that really shows off her vocal prowess.
That sounds great. Karen, you approve?
Sure.
Great. That is our show. Thanks to Karen. Thanks to LZ. Appreciate y'all. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Discord, get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcast Discord/podcast Facebook. Get the stickers, get the t-shirts. It's the podcast.myshopify.com. Karen, maybe we should just put all of these on the article page. I feel like, how did it take me like 4 years to figure this out? Maybe we should just have like furniture text. Anyway,
that's we'll fine. Come back. It's a tad promotional, but sure.
That's, I'm just saying. I sometimes I feel like I'm cut and pasting myself, and I realize it could just all be in one place. Anyway,
I enjoy hearing you monologue this every week. Are you kidding?
Okay, good. I'm glad. For those who listen all the way to the end, the real ones know. Subscribe to podcasts. Anyway, get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and newly YouTube. And also on the NYT audio app. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Here are Champagne Kisses.